In 3, 2, 1, and boom, we're live. Welcome to, or welcome back to Call Me on the Way Home. I'm your host, Austin Watts, and I am with Thomas Lau Kung, Thomas Kung Lau, excuse me. It's so good that you're here. So how is married life? First question you asked me before we hit live. Sorry. Married life is great, man. I'm grossly inadequate of a husband, but I've got lots of room for improvement. It's man, it's a blessing. It's such a blessing to have somebody, have a partner, you know, every day, try to get a little better. She's incredible. Have you and her ever met? Have we done dinner, the four of us? We haven't.
I still owe you guys a dinner.
Okay. And correctly pronounce your name again for me.
Thomas Lau.
Oh, okay. So what, I threw the K in there for no reason?
You can throw it in there. I mean, that's my middle name.
Oh,
you
know, okay. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, hey, well, the podcast is exactly what we're doing. The concept is kind of to learn from people, like, because you've got knowledge that I don't have. That's why you're the consultant. You know, and I'm the sales guy, right? And so it's basically me getting in touch with people and recording some of the fun conversations I have with them, because I've really enjoyed getting to know you and what you do. But yet there's still lots about you I don't know. I really only know you on a professional level. You know, I know some of the personal stuff with your ties to, I believe, Cambodia, right? And so right. That's really all it is. It's just me getting to know you and finding out what the latest is with you. One of the interesting things I remember about you is you told me you knew after you visited maybe November of 19 or December of 19, you visited Cambodia and you knew something was coming.
Right, the pandemics.
How did you know that? How did you have your finger on that?
We saw what happened in China. And saw what the Chinese government was actually doing to the Chinese in Wuhan, and saw those clips that they got smuggled out, and it didn't make sense. I mean, I've never, you know, it just doesn't seem right. And when they're starting to implement quarantines, and when they already started it in December, and when they started shutting down Wuhan. Mm-hmm. Then I knew something was wrong. I said, no, I mean, that doesn't seem right. It doesn't really seem right. In January, they have the military wearing in white Tyvek suits, carrying guns, and they're walking down the street and you can hear shootings. And the video clip that came out was from residents from their apartment building. So when you saw that going on, I said, this ain't right. That was January.
January of 2020. Yeah.
Right. That was January 2020. I said, that's not right. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, I said, you know, I've seen movies before. This is pretty bad.
Yeah. That's what
we decided that, you know, this could be a global pandemic. And that was the term that I use among my family and also among our team members. And I said, you know, let's talk about the worst case scenarios. Worst case scenario is that we have a pandemic. What do we do in a pandemic? I don't know. But first thing we need to do was PPE, you know?
Yeah.
So I went to Home Depot and stocked up on a lot of N95. Enough to last us for 2 years. And the surgical glove, we just went to CVS. And they have plenty of surgical gloves.
In January, there was plenty.
Yeah, there was plenty. I mean, just go to CVS and the Home Depot has plenty of Tyvek suits.
Yeah, man.
You know, so we clean up most of the Tyvek suits and they keep on bringing them. You know, we had a lot of it. Pandemics hit. Well, what we end up with is that we didn't use a lot of our PPE. We didn't use even 10% of our PPE. We end up donating them to the medical responders.
Yeah.
Because we didn't expect to be shut down.
Yeah.
You know,
because if you would have kept going out, you probably would have used it. But if you are indoors and you're by yourself or you're at home, then you don't need it as in the quantity. That makes sense. How is 99 Universal? Universal 99. Please tell my audience what your business is that you own.
We are environmental engineering and consulting company, okay. Primarily in the field of environmental compliance.
Mm-hmm.
We handle anything from air, hazardous materials, hazardous waste, industrial wastewater, and stormwater. Those are the general scope, if you will. Okay. Yeah, when it comes to identifying the what's environmental feel is like, the US EPA regulates air emissions for both stationary source and also primarily stationary source. You know, stationary source are, you know, factories. Those are all stationary source
as opposed to
as opposed to mobile source. That would be your vehicles. You know, those are the mobile source. And then, of course, hazardous materials and hazardous waste.
Yeah.
So hazardous materials, anything that is flammable, toxic, corrosive, or, you know, reactive is deemed as hazardous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hazardous waste is materials that can no longer be used. It is now deemed as hazardous waste, you know. And then industrial wastewater, any processed water that has gone through in the industrial process where there's cleaning, such as simple as a car wash, you know. That goes into the public sewer system that gets to be treated before they either release it or recycle it or reuse it for irrigations.
Oh, okay.
And they regulate industrial source of wastewater. And then on the other side of it is stormwater. Or you figure, well, what's stormwater, right? Sounds so weird.
Is that? Well, okay. You're about to tell me. Okay. I'm not going to guess. Okay.
Stormwater is actually rainwater, you know, and whenever you have rainwater that comes down and, you know, and wash, they can obviously, rainwater would typically carry the pollutants that is laid on the ground or come in contact with industrial process, and that gets washed into the storm drains. I mean, case in point would be, you notice after the first day of rain on the freeway, when you drive that car, you get really nice grip. That's because rainwater is slightly acidic because of the CO2 in our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of it, you know, it washes all the pollutants away, you know, right into the storm drains and goes into the river, the streams, and the oceans. Those are heavily regulated in the United States, especially more so in California.
Yeah.
So we manage that part of the business too as well. That's in a nutshell.
Okay. Nutshell. So I always ask people like basically four questions. You just answered the first one. The second one is, where are you? Where is your business located and what's kind of your territory, if you will?
We're located in Southern California, in Rancho Cucamonga, which is in the Inland Empire. Now, why do we select it here? You know, the United States is the most stringent when it comes to environmental regulations in the world, actually. California, of course, meet and actually exceeds US EPA. And California is further breaking down into different regions and different districts, depending on what areas. Let's say, for instance, like air, I think was broken down to about 30 districts.
Okay. You know?
And then where we're located, Southern California, which is the four counties, LA, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Orange County. This area here is regulated under South Coast Air Quality Management Districts. You know, San Diego has their district, which is San Diego APCD. The Bay Area has their own district and so forth.
Yeah.
So each district can meet or exceed that of the California mandate.
Hmm.
So South Coast, you know, has the most stringent regulations in all of California. And then South Coast is also kind of broken down into coastals and inland. So, and inland, well, we're the most polluted because of the fact that we're located in the basin. So most of the air pollution coming from the jet streams from China and also from the coastal side of it.
From LA?
It settles, it gets settled in our basins. And here we are. I mean, we have so much smog, you know. When I see smog, you know, the job security, cha-ching.
That's why I brought you on the podcast. You say it how it is. And it is. And like when you're not from California, which I'm a transplant, I did not realize how effective those mountains were at trapping air. I did not understand until I drove around a couple of times. And then you get a couple of fires. Like, was it the Azusa fire a couple of years ago? Man, it almost blacked out that area. Rancho Cucamonga, Colton, the Redlands. Like, I was like, why is it so dark? And then, you know, you look on Twitter, you look online, and there's a big fire, you know, and there's nowhere else for the air to go, because it's not going to just go up over the mountain for no reason. It's just going to sit there. And then you got to do something with it. So,
and it's not that we pollute more, you know, the chemicals that is able to be used in, let's say, the Bay Area, we can't use it here. It's because of we have to go with extreme low VOC, you know, low pollutants materials.
Yeah.
It's just how our basin, it's just how we geographically located.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So there's two out of four, and then we can talk about whatever we want. So the second two are about something you've mastered. So I'm always curious, beyond the face value of somebody, is there something you feel you've gained a really good hold on or a really good ability to pinpoint? Because that's what's fascinating to me about my friends, is they've all done something in life that they're above average at. Because the people I hang out with, they're not lame people. They're above average people. And they're good at something. And normally, I don't know what it is. And because time, distance, you separated high school, college, you know, you have a professional career and families, you get sort of separated from folks. And, you know, I haven't seen you in at least a year and a half. I mean, it's been a long time. And so that's the first question. The second one is, what are you in the process of doing? That you're trying to get better at, but you've not figured out all the way. So either one of those you want to take on. And if not, I got some other questions.
You ask a really interesting questions, your first questions. What I'm really good at is I have degrees in what I call PhDs. And to me, PhD stands for poor, hungry, and driven. when you have those PhDs, you have the drive to succeed. And my PhDs came from the fact that I came from communist countries in Cambodia, where half of the population were executed and everybody was gave free job, you know, free employment. You work in the rice, the leech infested rice paddy fields, and they give you free food and free healthcare. Is that if they don't kill you that day, if you survive that day, you know, that's healthcare. So I lived through that type of environment where half of my family member was already executed, you know, and I was supposed to be executed too. I was supposed to be dead twice. That'll take another 3-4 hours to, you know, to explain. That'll be a separate subject all to itself. Love to share that story one of those days. So, and when I come to you, and back then, when we were living among the Khmer Rouge, you know, they force us to live in a little hut home. Hut home is, you know, the walls made of clay and the roof is made of straw.
Straw, yeah.
And the room is maybe, you know, less than 10 feet by 10 feet in size. And that's it. You know, you sleep on the ground and you work from sunrise to sunsets. And they give you a can of a rice to eat a day, you know, just a little can. That's per person. And if they catch you eating earthworms and, you know, whatever the lizards that you find on the road, or pick a fruits that you see on the streets, they kill you and your whole family right there and then. You know, so I witnessed all of that. When I came to the United States when I was 9 years old.
What year was that? What year were you in that? And then what year did you come over?
Back in 75.
Okay.
I lived in the refugee camps in Thailand.
Okay.
Refugee camp in 76. Lived there for about a year and then immigrated to the United States. Back then, there was about 10, 20, 30 countries were having open invitations for what they call refugee immigrants from Southeast Asia. And I was among the group that actually came to the United States in 76.
Wow. Okay. See, so, I don't like, I knew some of that. I don't think I knew how young you were and what you saw. Did who pays for that ticket? Like, do you get on a cruise ship or was it an airplane?
It was an airplane. It was, if I have to imagine, I would imagine that it was the UN that paid for it. That's what I would imagine, okay. You know, and I would imagine the United States would pocket out those expenses. And you know, I've my loyalty is to the United States of America. I have to get off track a little bit. I love the United States of America. I appreciate every moment I live in this great country. You know, without the United States of America, I wouldn't be here today. I would have been dead. And my entire family would have been dead. So, yeah, I mean, it. And when we came here, I had no shred of education.
Oh, wow.
I came here completely.
You knew that local language, right, from Cambodia. What's the local
language? Cambodians. I speak some multiple languages, but the local language is Khmer or Cambodians, you know. During the Khmer Rouge raid, you know, there was no education. Schools were turned into prison camps and torture chambers. Teachers were being executed because they don't want smart, intelligent thinkers. So if you wear glasses, you're among the second wave of people to be round off and executed.
Wow.
So, yeah. And if you have nice, beautiful hands such as these, you'll be the next group of people to be executed too. That means that you've got to be intelligent, you know?
What is it about the hands? What is that?
Well, they want hardworking people. They want they want what they call like peasants, if you will.
Like
you
know, farming, want... farmhand, like a real rough. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but if you have hands like these, it means that you come from a high, better socioeconomic class. So therefore, you must be educated, and therefore, we can't allow to have people like you. You know,
because you know better. Because you know better.
Exactly. Yeah. So they, one of the things that they did was that they executed teachers, you know, and then they put everybody through their form of education, which is indoctrinations of of communism, you know, to the point where they turn their children's, indoctrinations of communism is so effective, especially among the younger people. Children's would actually eavesdrop on the parents' conversations. You know, about communist ideology. Of course, as the parents, you know, you're free, you know, you would disagree with communists and Marxism. So when the children hear that, the children would turn the parent in for executions.
Wow.
Yeah. It's children are easily manipulated. I do learn that firsthand in Cambodia. You know, it's incredible how children can be easily manipulated at such a young age.
You know, so, I've started to see that with my wife, I think, as you know, teaches at Pepperdine, and every Christian school. So it's a Church of Christ school and we go to the Church of Christ, and every Church of Christ school in the country, Florida College, Harding University, Faulkner, Lipscomb, Fried Hardman, they all have a lectureship series. They all have a week and a half where everybody comes in from outside of town. They speak on a bunch of different subjects and a lot of people show up. And she said the first year when she went, the things that she saw were not biblical based things. So here's a school that's literally through the bookstore advertising things that don't sync up with what scripture has been for thousands of years. And you're like, this looks a little off. Something's off here. You know, and it's the back to your idea. It's if I can get a book in your child's hand, if I can get an idea across through a movie or a cartoon or through the cereal box, I got them.
You know, Austin, that's another subject all to itself, and I'll share a little bit with you. I have a 9-year-old and also a 12-year-old in public schools in Altaloma school districts. You know, I'm taking them out of the, we bought this place here and renovated. We spent quite a bit of money renovating this place, this new home. I'll give you a little view of it.
Okay.
And the purpose of it is because the school is literally right next door to us. That's why we picked it. You know, it's not the most beautiful place. And we spend quite a bit. We spent more than what we purchased, more than the purchase price of the house. I mean, just renovating the house because we want to put our kids into what we known as, what we believe is the best school districts, at least in the Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm.
When I go through the curriculums of my children's, you know, and then and see what they're learning. And for instance, they're learning about global warming. Excuse my French. You know, I'm an environmental engineer. Man-made global warming is a nonsense. You know, because we're in the air, I'm going to use my I'm going to be a little bit more politically correct.
Sure.
Words. It's nonsense. You know, I don't believe in that. You know, we've been warming up for the last half billion years already since the end of the Ice Age. So there's a lot of stuff and there's no real science behind it, you know, because it's pretty simple. We want to argue it. If it's real science about behind it, then of course 100% of the scientists would agree upon it. But global warming, there's not 100% scientists agree upon it. You know, science is science. Like for instance, gravities. Does anyone disagree on gravities? That's science right there,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
When they're learning things such as, you know, this crazy subjects such as this, I thought to myself, I said, this is not right. And then worst of all is that they don't teach your kids to be thinkers.
Mm.
You know, critical thinkings don't exist anymore here. You know, when I was in school, when I was in high school, critical thinking was one of the subjects that was taught, you know.
As a subject, as a class you took?
Yes, that was in high school, you know, that was back in the 80s.
Now,
critical thinking is they teach you to feel. They don't teach you to think anymore, you know. So I could go on and on about this, about the indoctrination of our children's, but
so you pulled your kids out.
Starting the end of this year.
In the fall.
So in other words, I'm putting them into Christians Academy School, which is it's called United Christians Academy.
Okay.
I'm putting them into a Christian school because they don't teach CRT. Critical race theories, you know, it's nothing but more than just a modified version of Marxism. Critical race theories, you know.
And if, of all the people I think I've ever met, and I've met thousands of people, went to college with thousands of people, went to conferences, traveled at least to three other countries besides America. There's no one more ready than a Khmer Rouge exiled immigrant who can aptly say, this looks like a step away from communism.
It's communism 101. I've seen it before. You know, first in every communist country in Cambodia, first thing they did was that they parade communism, the communists, the Khmer Rouge. They parade them. They welcome them because promises of socialism. You hear that, right? From the liberal left. And then after that, they come and take away your gun. They try to take out Second Amendment.
Yeah.
Right? They can't take away a gun. So then now they try to take away our bullets. After they take away the gun, then they come knocking on the door and they come for your father. He is amongst the first to go.
Oh yeah.
And you never see your father again. After that, then they divide and conquer. Literally divide and conquer. Yeah. You know. And that's what they're doing now to us in the United States, is divide and conquer. We're so divided right now. Before these crazy leftists woke, you know, which started about 4 years ago when after Trump takes office, before Trump takes office, we were living in harmony. After Trump takes office, they decided that they wanted to divide America, and they labeled Donald Trump as a racist. Before he took office, he was the most beloved person. All the liberal left wants him. All the black wants to take his pictures with him. You know, everybody seen him as an idol. But after he takes office, you know, he was demonized, and they throw racism in there just to divide us all.
Yeah.
So what's happening in the United States now is nothing more than what the deja vu that I visited, you know, that I've seen that happened in Cambodia back in the early 70s.
Why do you think somebody would not listen to you say something like that? Like you have the experience, you have the knowledge, you walk through that. Like, why wouldn't a voice like yours be more amplified?
The reason is because conservatives has a different point of view in life. Conservative mentality is that, leave me alone. You know, I mean, you look at back in the 1700s, mm-hmm. when the founding fathers and when the American immigrant from Europe came, mm-hmm. what are we looking for? You know, we're still looking for peace and quiet. You know, let me work, let me do my job. Let mm-hmm. me feed my family. You know, I don't want nothing else. I just want to take care of my family. That's what conservative mindsets are. The conservative people like us, it's pretty simple. It's like, look, let me keep my gun. Let me protect my family. Let me feed my own family. You know, I don't need handout. You know, I have pride in building, making things for myself.
Yeah.
I don't care for entitlement. The government's job is to protect us, not to run our lives. I got it from Ronald Reagan, by the way. You know, so, and as a result of it, that's why the conservatives are the silent majorities. And that's the problem with us. We're the silent majorities. You know, we don't go out banging pots and pans and blowing things up and burning things up. We're very peaceful people in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. So in my opinion, to answer your questions, are there a lot of people? Yes, there's a lot of us. I believe that we are the silent majority. It's just like the problem with us is that we're silent. Well, just recently, I think we're beginning to have it up to here. So we begin to speak out now against CRTs, you know, against the teachers associations and all.
Mm-hmm.
That's my first answer. My second answer is that the problem that we have, you know, the root of all problem that we have started from an educational system. And let me explain a little bit.
Please.
Remember what I say, that children are really easily manipulated?
Yeah.
Okay. To the point they can turn their parents in for executions. The parents of all the people. The school system is educating our children since kindergarten on what? On communism, socialism, and CRT. These groups of idiots, I have to call them idiots, who take their freedom, you know, that was earned in blood, to burn down the country, to bring us back into communism. And why? And what their age are? They're the millennium. You know, they're in their 20s and 30s. So they were indoctrinated by the school system. And that's what they believe in. You know, they're not trained to think. They're trained to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And the fruits of the indoctrination by the school system is right there in Portland, Oregon. You know, that's perfect examples. In New York and everything else that we see that is happening there as well. It's the indoctrinations. The teachers union got to go. What they're doing is horrible. They're indoctrinating our kids. They're not teaching them our kids to think. Where the rest of the world, third world countries, does just the opposite. Educating the children to think, to be critical thinkers. That's the roots of all the problem. If we do not solve that fundamental roots, because in a family, okay, children spend the second most amount of time that the children spend their lives on in is actually school, their teachers, next to their home with the mother and father and the sibling is a school.
Mm-hmm.
So the school itself is the roots of the problem. The teachers unions are the roots of all the problem.
What does the teacher union do? I don't know what those are, and they don't have them in Georgia.
Teachers unions.
Are they the curriculum setters?
Everything. They're everything. They have the last say so over everything. They're the administrators. They're down to the teachers and the janitors, you know. And they get to pick what they want they get to choose the curriculums. I highly disagree with the materials that they educate our children in,
mm-hmm.
especially CRT. That they're teaching our children, global warming, non-scientific materials.
Hmm.
And they teach them to feel.
Where does the critical race theory come from? Is there a particular book you know about?
Critical race theory is actually came from, it's a form of Marxism. You know, so it's communist from, if you look at it, if you look at critical race theory, it actually is a derivative of Marxism, Karl Marx.
Yeah.
So it's communist. So yeah. I mean,
I guess I was more curious about, like, how does that curriculum show up in my mind? Is it just a chapter in the science book? Is it additional reading? Like, is it the videos they're showing? Is it a combination of all of that?
Combination of everything that you just mentioned. Okay. It's combinations. Yeah. Okay. Even the online tutorial that my children have actually learned and taught, you know, they input it a little bit here and there, here and there, here and there. Eventually, the whole complete, the children get the whole complete pictures. Critical race theories, it's to spell it, to say it bluntly, they tell you that if you're non-white, you're the oppressed. Mm. If you're white, you're the oppressor. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's nothing you can do in this lifetime in the United States of America, because we're such a racist country that you can never succeed and work yourself out of hellhole. I beg the difference. Because in my garage, I have a McLaren, a Mercedes, and BMWs, and other toys. And by the way, I'm getting my second McLaren. I'm putting the order in.
So business is good.
So I make the difference, you know, and it's not true.
Yeah, it's not.
But they teach you that just to divide us.
Mm.
You know, and it's divide and conquer.
Yeah.
The only person who really benefits in a Marxist societies is pretty simple. You look at who benefits in Cuba, who benefits in Venezuela, and who benefits in North Korea.
The state.
The leader of the states.
Correct.
He is God.
Yeah.
That's it. He's not a king. He's beyond king. He's a god, you know, and everyone else suffers.
Yeah. That is, you know, like, this podcast has no form. Like I don't have any agenda. The agenda is for me to call awesome people and record some of the great conversations. And, you know, you said, pardon my French, and then you didn't say any French. And so I was a little disappointed with that, but that's okay. You know, I get it. You know, you're being recorded. No problem. You know, and your public personality and your business depends on anything you do in the public. So I get that part. One of the things that I'm trying to do is trying to, like, understand how things work, right? Because I'm not going to figure it all out, but I'm going to figure a few things out. And one of the fascinating things to me is to see different people try different new things, just to see what's going to work and what's going to pay well and what the market responds to. And so I was curious if there's something you've not figured out that you're, like, trying to work on that's not really all the way dialed in yet.
There is another part to that. And it linked to your previous questions also as well. Mm-hmm. You asked the first question as to, I think it was something to effect of what I have not, what drives me or something like that. What makes me successful in that sense? The answer is the fear of hunger, literally the fear of hunger. You know, I don't throw away food. I try not to throw away food. It's the fear of hunger. You know, that's the drive. I remember that I was always hungry, literally always hungry, you know. And that it was embedded into my subconscious. Therefore, I always, I have to work hard. Yeah. It's hard work, not only hard work, and hard work translates to also working smart, as smart as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if I can answer your questions correctly. The other thing I'm trying to figure out in life is, what is life altogether? What is it? What's all of this? I mean, what's the ultimate meaning to all of this? Why? You know, they say what, in the name of, in the game of life, no one makes it out alive. Correct. I haven't seen one person make it out alive yet, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay, I escaped death twice. You know, that gave me the drive to do what I do. I mean, it was not an easy escape. It was a really hard escape. I'll share a little bit with you.
You know, I have no problem going down that rabbit hole and hearing that story in its long form. Like, I don't have a set time. I got nothing to do tonight. And so however much you want to share, I'm okay with.
Okay. I'll give you a condensed version of my experience with the Khmer Rouge. Okay. And I think that will give you a little bit more insight as to why I have such a drive.
Yeah.
You know, and then that would lead to the next question as to why I have to suffer, or why I had to suffer, and why suffering's existence, and what's all of this? You know, what's all of this? What's the meaning of life, or what's the purpose of life, and what is it in it for me, and what am I doing moving forward in preparations for the future, and what is the futures, the ultimate future that I believe it's going to be? So let me take a step back and go through a little bit of a condensed history of Khmer Rouge. When they bombed the capital, they actually bombed, when the Khmer Rouge came over, by the way, I highly recommend to watch this movie that is done by Angelina Jolie. There's two movies concerning on the subject of Khmer Rouge. One is called The Killing Field, that was dated back in the late 70s, early 80s. The Killing Field is good, but Killing Fields is, you get one different, let me close the door real quick.
Oh, you're good, take your time. The Killing Fields, F-I-E-L-D-S?
Yes.
Okay.
The Killing Field is an older movie. It's really good. Okay. And then I think you may even find it in YouTube, you know. The second movie is a little bit newer. It's, I think, about 3-4 years old. It was produced by Angelina Jolie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she did a really good depictions of what actually happened during the Khmer Rouge reign. You know, she did a good job. It's not what's that term I want to use? It's not as violent, if you will, but you get the gist of what's happening, you know, of everything that I explained. So when they bombed the capital, you know, they evacuate everyone. It's divide and conquer. Families are all been broken up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, literally families are all broken up, you know. And from my mother's perspective, give the condensed versions, when our hometown was bombed, you know, we live in a nice house. The walls is not made, you know, there's no drywall in Asia.
I imagine
the walls
concrete. Are made
of concrete. Yeah, so it took my mom a few days to chisel her way, you know, through the kitchens. To chisel away the hole big enough for my mother and my older sister to crawl out of the house. And about 100, I think maybe a few hundred yards, you know, from the house, my sister took the hit and she died in my mom's arm. Well, and at that time, my sister was about 16 years old. Well, my mother could not give my sister a former burial, you know, because what? In the war zone, you can't do that, right?
You don't have time.
So she kind of, you just wrap the body and leave the body there where the body lay. And my mom had to crawl to safety. She was the first victim. No, she was the second victim in our family, you know. The first victim of my family, right when the war was about to break out, you know, my uncle received a fake letter from my grandmother saying that she is sick. So he rode his bike, you know, on Highway 4, and they ambush him and they make him dig his own grave. They hit him behind his head, you know, either with an axe or a bat, and they bury him. And that's a typical killing, by the way. You don't die. You die, you know, after they bury you. That's most of the death. So everybody was forced, there was a forced evacuations, and everybody was round up and distributed among different camps, you know, and you work in those camps. First thing they do is that they take all your clothes. They dye them gray, because in communism, there's only one color. Everybody's equal, remember? That's communism. Right? It's, yeah. Communism is equality of result, not equality of opportunities, where freedoms and capitalism is just the opposite. It's equality of opportunities, yeah. You know, not equality of result, not distributions of other people's wealth. Well, in communism, that's what that is. So we were forced to live, you know, in the labor camp for up to about 6 months. And we knew too that as we're every family who were forced to work in the labor camp, they think that they always want to do their homework as who you are. And then once they figured out who you are, then you're taken from the labor camp and then executed one at a time. And by the way, the movie that Angelina Jolie did, you know, she actually got that, she actually put that in her movie too. That's why her this particular movie that she did, it's called First They Kill My Father. That's what, you know, that's that movie there, like I said, she did a pretty good job, you know, of giving the historical facts. So anyway, I'll cut through the whole condensed, you know, I'll give a little bit more of the condensed
whatever
version.
Version. Don't feel rushed. Like, this is just when listening and paying attention.
So we're forced to work, you know, with me, my family, we came from a family of 9 children. Of the 9 children, my older sister, we don't know where they are, you know, when the war broke out. With me was that my older brother and one younger brother. So only 3 kids of the 9 kids, you know. So there was my mom and dad, my one older brother, me, and my younger brother, and that's it. And we live in this hut, this little hut home, and we have no contact or connections. And we have no idea who's in, you know, where people are at. We knew too that it was only a matter of time when they figured out who we are, and then we'll be round up and executed too as well. Our job was to work, sunrise, we go to the leech infested rice paddy field. Planting rice, you know, water is knee high.
Mm-hmm.
And there are leech there, lots of leech, you know.
Oof.
So you have to stick a rice stalks down underneath the soils, mm-hmm. one at a time, you know. That's slave labor camps. And then I was in charge of collecting the rice from the family of 5, we get 5 cans of rice. You know, if you look at the carnation cans, you know, the carnation milk can, if you want the condensed milk can.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, I will not talk about the corn cans, just carnation. That's the size of the,
I would say tuna cans, little small, that size, like the 3 ounce.
I have it, hold on.
You have one?
Okay, yeah, take your time. Here it is. It's about this size.
About an 8-ounce can.
Yep. So they would scoop it up, you know, and in plastic bags. So I get to pick up 5 cans of rice in the morning before I go to work. And that's all the food they gave it to us. Now, of course, we always have negative calories, so we've always been hungry. My mom, you know, and our kitchen is actually 3 pieces of stone in the corner of the hut home. So you got a pot, and she would take the rice and she would boil it and puts a lot of liquid in there, a lot of water. So it becomes like porridge, if you will. As a kid, I'm always hungry, you know, and my mom would give us a little bit more solids. She drinks a lot more liquid on her side. That's all we get. You know, that's communism. And my mom would always, we found out later, you know, that my mom would siphon a little bit of rice per day as she would keep it, you know, for a rainy day, as she would bury it in our kitchen's ground, save it for the rainy day. So a day came that there was a family of little 3 children. It was a mother, father, I think the children was maybe about 4, 5, 6 years old, you know, plus or minus a few years.
Yeah.
Little kids. The girl who works right next to the rice paddy field with my mom. Well, when you're always hungry, you know, sometimes you subconsciously say out certain words because you can't you always think about it. And she happened to utter the word, I'm hungry. Well, there's a 10-year-old kid who is part of the Khmer Rouge. He's holding an AK-47 and he's walking the levee, you know, guarding. And he overheard it, that this girl complained that she was hungry just by uttering the word that I am hungry. That evening after work, a Khmer Rouge lady, you know, carrying an AK-47, escorted this family of five in front of our house into the riverbank. And we were told that this family is going to be sent and relocated to work elsewhere. And that's what we saw, and that's what we heard. Momentarily later, you know, we heard gunshot, you know. And momentarily after the gunshots, we see the Khmer Rouge girl, you know, who carried the AK-47, walk past out the front of our house, filled with blood, you know, blood splatter her body. So we knew, okay, that's another family gone, you know, like nothing that we had never seen before. We always seen it. So we knew that we're only going to be next. And the question is when? Well, I'm going to move the story up a little bit about this particular girl and her family. She has, we met her, actually. We met her in Chinatown in 1980 in a wedding in Chinatown, Los Angeles. Of all the places, you know, she told us, she said, and we were so surprised. You are alive, what happened? And this is what she told us, her account. They walk into the riverbank and the children are on their knee, you know, kneel, you know, like this. You know, you put your hand behind your back, right?
Yeah,
on your knee. So you got the father and you got the little children. She herself, she said, and remember this is the jungle. So the riverbank jungle, there's all vegetation.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So she said, can I go to the restroom to do my number? Well, everybody's do go to, I mean, there's no toilet, of course, right?
Yeah, it's the jungle.
It's a jungle.
I got it.
That's how we do it too. You know, you clean yourself with leaves.
Yeah.
So she go behind the bushes, she does her number. And what she heard and what happened was that her husband was attacked, you know, with a bat behind his
the back of the head, the brainstem.
So when they hit him hard enough, you know, multiple times, he fell, but he was kind of incapacitated. He's not dead yet. So then she went after the children, one at a time. Well, the little one, you know, screams, said, mommy, help, mommy, help. She's killing us. So mommy, you know, got up and looked up what happened. Saw that her family would be executed. There's nothing she could do. So she would jump into the river and start swimming. I mean, just start swimming, navigate to the river. That's when the AK-47 came in. They would try to shoot her. Well, she escaped. She navigates from Cambodia to Thailand, to the refugee camps in Thailand. It took her about 6 months to navigate because of during the nighttime, you know, there's, you know, Khmer Rouge are everywhere. There's camps everywhere. So what she did was that she, at night, she would climb the coconut trees and she would, you know, pick the coconuts and tear it with her hands. She survived off coconut for 6 months. Wow. And eventually made her way to the refugee camps, the UN refugee camps in Thailand, and then came to the United States. Wow. That's the back end story of her story, you know. We thought that she was just another family that was gone. And we knew too, we said, you know what? Our time is going to be here one of these days, sooner or later. We got to escape. We can't be here. We have to take risks to escape. So imagine Thailand, Cambodia to Thailand is almost from here to San Francisco, yeah, if you will.
It's a long way.
You know, it is a long way. So there was a holiday. We don't know what God, whatever holiday they gave us. And they said that, hey, you can take a day off. Wow, a day off, right? So we take the day off to scavenge for food. And then we planned the escape with another friend. There was another family that's of two girls, two teenage girls. I think they're about 16 years old, you know, plus or minus. They are two teenage girls and a husband and wife. And they said, can we escape with you? So we're a family of five and they're a family of four.
That's a lot of people.
A lot of people. And they said, yeah, let's go. We're going to roll to Thailand, you know? And so we planned the escape route with another friend. He's single and he is a low risk in their eyes. So we said, hey, let's do this. Let us ask for a small rowboat, just a small one, that we want to scavenge for mangrove roots, you know, right by the riverbank. You know, because it's where salt and fresh water is coming in contact. So if we ask for a small rowboat, then they think that that we're low risk, you know, that we're not going to escape in a rowboat. So this friend of ours who's single, he said he's going to go fishing, you know, out in the oceans. So therefore he can have a bigger rowboat. Long story short, my mom, you know, all the little rice that she's been saving, you know, little cans a day, you know, a little bit. So she cooked those rice, you know, and the way she cooked it, she would pan fry it. There's no oils involved, you know, it's like almost popcorn like, if you will.
Yeah.
So we put it inside the bag and we took the rowboat, you know, the family of five, to the riverbank, and we rowed to meet our friends out in the ocean to swap boats. To swap boat, because that little rowboat is not going to be able to make it to Thailand, not in a family of five, you know.
What do you mean you swap rowboats?
Okay. Our friend who has the bigger rowboat who's fishes in the oceans.
Oh, got it. Okay, I'm with you.
Okay.
Your friend was the fisherman. So he had a bigger boat. He had like a commercial, quote unquote, a commercial vessel versus.
Right. Just a bigger rowboat. Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. A bigger rowboat, you know, longer that you can row, you know, it's a single person rowboat, but yes, it's bigger as opposed to a little tiny rowboat that has nine people in there altogether.
You put all nine people in that tiny little rowboat?
Okay. Yep. And so, and we met with him in the middle of the oceans, and then we swapped boats. So when that happened, I remember that there was an incident, that there was a, as we were rolling out of the, as we're leaving to Cambodia's walk, as we're leaving the land behind and move toward the salt water, I was sitting in the back of the boat, you know. So my mom and dad, you know, they were rolling along with my older brother and another family of four. I remember a pair of two flying fish, you know, jumped into a boat. And we thought, oh my God, right? Food, right? My mom said to us, don't hurt them, don't eat them. They must be sent by God. This is an omen, sent by God to protect us. So we throw them back into the oceans. And I sat in the back of the boat like this. And you know, the boats always rock up and down because of the wave, right? You get the heat, you got the humidities, and
sunlight.
We're just rolling.
Yeah,
exactly. They're just rolling, and they're rolling away from land as far as possible. So they keep on rolling and rolling. And for the next 3 days, it was a calm before the storm. You see floaters, you know, once in a while. You see floaters, those who didn't make it. You see them, you know, floating on because 3 million people actually died. Not 300,000, 3 million. Half the population was gone. So on around the third or fourth day, we run into a monsoon in the middle of the oceans. Oh my God. The wave, our little boat was this tiny, and we were up and down the wave. We were riding the wave up and down. We didn't capsize because my dad threw fishing nets overboard. So the fishing nets kind of give us a balance.
A little bit. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, by the time the storm, what saved us from the storm, we found an island that's just made of rock in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's like that Bacardi commercials. Mm-hmm. You know, a bunch of people mm-hmm. just throw a whole bunch of rocks, you know, in the middle of the oceans. And that's what saved us. So we stayed there until the storm passes, but we lost our food. We lost our water. There's nothing left. So what do we do, right? Either we died here in the middle of the oceans, or we take risks as we were rolling out, you know. So we decided to go take risks, to go near land, to look for food, to scavenge for food, if you will. It was almost about sunset, you know, as we decided to go toward land. And then we see a longtail. A longtail is a rowboat, is a boat, like our boat, you know, with a modified car engine and a propeller, you know, the long propeller that you've seen in those movies. Mm-hmm. So you see two girls, they're the Khmer Rouge girl, we didn't know, you know, and they came to intercept us. And they wave, you know, and they say in Cambodian, you know, Bampo on means brothers and sister, you know. They say, anything we can do to help you, come, you know. And we thought to ourselves, we said, hey, you know what? This is great. Maybe this is, you know, we met some nice people finally. So they take up, so they escort us to the shore. And we park a boat next to there. Then they escort us through the vegetation, because behind the beach, you can't see anything. It's all vegetation.
Oh, it's grown up real high.
Well, you know, it's a jungle. Yeah. You know, it's like the movie. It's just a jungle. You see coconut tree, also vegetation, and then in front you got water at the beach, and that's it. So they escort us. They navigate us through a little trail that lead inside, you know, between the vegetations, and inside was a village, and that village is our Khmer Rouge. Okay. So when we got inside, you got 10 guys with AK-47s just waiting to receive you, you know, and they pronounce, and they search our boat. They search my mom. My mom had a little strip of cloth, if you will. She used it like a belt to tie her pants into, you know, and she had with her diamond rings and a little precious stones. That's all, you know, because currency, money has no more value since there's no such thing as currency anymore. And they stripped her, and one of the diamond rings fell near her foot. She went and she stepped on it. She stood there while they were pronouncing our death sentence. They say that the two girls from this family will be raped and killed here tomorrow morning. This is the evening, you know. Tomorrow morning, these two girls will be raped and killed. And then your children will be killed tomorrow morning. But right now, we're not going to kill you yet. It's too late. We'll kill you tomorrow. So that evening, we literally slept with the enemy. You know those platform home that's made of woods and bamboo? Under downstairs is muds, you know, soils and water buffalo. You may have seen it in some of the Rambo movie, you know, those homes. So on top is a platform. So we slept with them, you know, and the head of the communities was there too. That evening, you know, I slept like a log, of course. My mom, of course, she couldn't sleep, right? She crawled on all four. Oh, by the way, the pair of flying fish, they've been escorting us all this while. You know, there is someone looking after us. It's there. Anyway, so in the evening, my mom would crawl on all of her four, and she, you know, she would. So I woke up along with my brothers and all, you know, and we came downstairs. Downstairs, you know, the ladder is actually wood.
Sure. You know,
we would crawl downstairs, and we went to the beach. Fortunately, the girl, the Khmer Rouge girl who was supposed to guard the boat, she went to sleep with another man. So we escaped death once right there. That doesn't count the monsoon, you know. So we escaped death, and we started, and it was pitch dark. So we start rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling. And we with all the excitement, we just took off with it. It was before noontime. We saw a speedboat coming after us. Not a rowboat, not its long tail, but a speedboat coming after us.
Oh boy.
And that was the scariest moment I have ever seen. I remember that well, we had 2 days, no food and no water. After the monsoon, you know, they're not going to feed us and they're going to kill us. So there's no food, no water. We haven't been eating. And the adults, as they are rolling and rolling, first they were hungry. They don't have water, no water, no food. And, you know, death is coming at you. So they lost the will to live. They accepted already that they're going to die, you know. And for me, I have never been so scared until that particular moment. As I see them coming closer and closer and closer at us within our line of sight, I prayed. And I remember I broke down, literally broke down. And I put my hand up and I said in Chinese, you know, I said, Ti ti hu jiao, jia ye bin ma hon hon nan jiao ke. I cried and cried and cried. What that means is that gods of heaven and earth, please block the sight, you know, blind the sight or block the sight. Let us escape. And I cried and I cried. I actually literally broke down. I was 8 years old at the time. So as it got closer and closer and closer, they made a U-turn. I'm here today. If they didn't make the U-turn, I wouldn't be here today, you know, talking to you. So, once they made a U-turn, we stayed in a kind of like a gulf or peninsula, if you will. Spent the night there, just make sure all the coasts are clear, looking for food, water, whatever we can find. And we knew the area is infested with those Khmer Rouge, those communists, because we found their shoes. Their shoes is made of cut off car tire. And then the shoe strings are the inner tubes of the car tire, you know. So we found it, and those shoes last forever, of course.
Yeah.
We found the shoe, and we said, you know, we can't stay here. So the next day, you know, we start rolling out, just roll out. We don't care. We can't stay. Just roll out, and we start rolling. And lo and behold, we saw like a fleet of about 10, at least 10, huge fishing trawlers, you know. And these are huge. These must have like hundreds of employees in there. And they're from Taiwan, from the country of Taiwan. You know, they come to sneak in and fish, you know, in Cambodian water, is because Cambodian water is among Southeast Asia, Cambodian water is perhaps the richest in seafood, you know. So they would, and there are tens of these vessels. So we picked the closest one and we rolled to them. This was almost noontime, you know. They saw us and they zoomed away. Of course, right?
Yeah. Why would they try to help you? You're probably bad news.
Exactly. And everything is a tricks, you know. The Khmer Rouge are filled with children and women and everyone else too. Who knows? And plus they would be scared because they're sneaking in to do some fishing.
That's right. It's illegal, or it's quasi illegal at this point. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little hairy. It's a little fuzzy. What's okay.
Right. There's no law. You know, you just take it. You just come in and sneak in and take whatever you can take and move out. So we identified the second one, and then we rolled to the second one, and the second vessel did not zoom away. So we asked for it. We were lost. They gave us food, water, and direction. Thailand that way. They gave us a little pot, you know, and charcoals. They gave us rice, a bag of rice, and fish that they caught.
Yeah.
My golly, we have food, you know, real food. Yeah. You know, I mean, meat for a long time. We haven't had meat, you know, so we have real food. And it took us, I think, another 2-3 days or 4 days before we run into a Thailand fishing shrimp trawlers, you know. And they saw us and they said, hey. And we said, can you help us? Can you take us to the refugee camps. We want to go to Thailand. They said, no, I can't do that, you know, because we have to make a catch. We're losing money. We've got expenses, you know, gasoline, you know, and diesels and everything else. So my mom said, took out the ring. They should compensate you for it, you know. So, and that's how we end up in Thailand.
Wow.
1975. During that time was 1975. And live in a refugee camp up until 1976. Refugee camp is another story all to itself, but refugee camp is, it's not Disneyland. It's actually rows and rows of hut homes, and at least no one's killing you. And they give us rice, more than I can to eat a day. You know, other food, we have to scavenge for yourself, but no one's killing us, you know?
Yeah.
So that's another story all to itself. You know? But anyway, that's the drive that I have. When I come to the United States, I was completely illiterate. I didn't go to school. There was no school, you know. And going to school in the United States, it wasn't an easy task, you know. So I always, because of the fear of hunger, that's what drives us. Now, my mom, when we came here, I'll make the story short. My mom worked as a seamstress. She never saw a piece of garment in her life before. She took a month, 2 months of practicing. This particular factory allowed her the opportunity for her to practice. She practiced for free, you know. And after that, which became good enough, she started sewing for them. And take some of those garment home, you know, to sew in a one bedroom apartment that we rented in back of the Dodger stadiums, you know, which the areas are all infested with Mexican gang, if you will, the Cholos, who love to beat the crap out of me. But
you're a Cambodian 10-year-old that doesn't know English or Spanish. Right.
And I learned pretty fast, by the way. Cuss words.
I bet you did.
And I learned to run really fast too. Long story short, so my mom was sewing, and she was making 25 cents, you know, per piece of garment.
Yeah.
You know, and my dad did the odd jobs, you know, anything that he could find to put food on the table. But man, there was food and there's freedom. It was great. I mean, we don't have money for ice creams, but it was great. I did not know what a McDonald's burger tastes like until I was in high school, literally in high school. And KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, I remember watching the cartoons, you know, the Flintstone, how they eat the drumsticks like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've always like dreaming about eating the drumsticks like that. Well, we didn't have enough money to eat that kind of drumsticks until I was in high school. You know, we made enough money to buy KFC. You know, at that time, they call it Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah.
Yep. So, but my job was, I knew too, the only way out of poverty was to study, was school. And I've always read the book. And every book I can read, I just read, you know. And school was really hard, especially English was hard. History was hard because English was involved, you know.
Every subject's in English. Yeah.
Yep, it was hard. So I study, when I went to college, I went to Cal State LA. You only find me in two places. The library, which hardly closes, and the engineering buildings, which never closed. I mean, holidays included too. And my best friend is at vending machines. You know, back then it was simple. You know, it was really, really, really simple.
A couple of quarters, I got lunch.
Yeah, exactly. And you find me there Christmas. We don't celebrate Christmas. So my Christmas is always, you know, right in Cal State LA engineering building.
What school were you at?
California State University, Los Angeles.
Oh, UCLA. Okay.
No. Cal State LA.
Cal State LA. UCLA. Okay. I don't think I know that one.
Cal State system, you got Cal State San Bernardino, Cal State, Cal State, I think there's multiple Cal State.
Okay.
Cal State is not as popular as UC system. UC is, you know, for the rich, better educated person, you know. Cal State is for the poor and the more practical, you know, and it's close to home. I can take the bus there to school.
Got it.
So I finished engineering and bust our butt, you know, and that's brought us to where we are here today.
Yeah.
So yes, my drive is actually poverty and hunger.
Yeah.
You know, and getting beat up by Mexican gangs, I learned things. But that's the best healthcare is that you don't die. You know, getting beat up is good. It's good healthcare. So
I was talking with a friend earlier this morning, and we were talking about how it is changing. You know, in my generation, so I'm 33. I was born in 88, came up in the 90s, graduated in the mid 2000s, went to school, finished college early 2010, 2011. And I'm pretty nervous about my generation because there's not enough of us that became engineers. A lot of us went into non-blue collar work. Yeah.
Art, gender sensitivity studies, and graduate in gender study and racial equality studies, and activists. They went to activists. I interviewed some potential employees and even tutored for my kids. Guess what they want to be? I lectured one of the Chinese family. Her daughters graduated from high school. I asked her, "What do you want to be when you grow up, other than rich?" All right, she laughed, of course, right?
Sure.
She said, "I want to be an activist." I said, "God and Lord." I lectured her. I said, "Your mother must sold the farm and took how many years to get to be legalized document? You know, I bet you your mother had to bring in at least $40,000 to pay someone to do the paperwork, you know, and had to wait so many years for her to gain this green card status. And then after that, she can sponsor you guys and bring you, you know, and then you guys here educate, you know, now educated, your mom working as what, do nails and salons, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you put yourself and then she put you to school here and you want to be an activist? Are you out of your freaking mind? I told her that, like that. I said, what a waste of life. Look at your mom and dad. You know, what does an activist want to give you? I said, activist is nothing more than you try to infringe upon other people's rights. That's what activists is. Leave them alone. Leave them alone. Let them do whatever they want to do. You know, if they want to hurt themselves, they want to hurt other people, leave them alone. It's not your job, you know, to try to police them. It's your job to take care of your own family. That's conservative.
Yeah.
You know, that's the silent majorities. You know, we just want to be left alone.
Yeah.
And that brought us to the second question as to, well, now that we got, you know, now that that we're here and we've been able to successfully, I would say we live the American dream, you know, despite what CRTs and everyone else, I live the American dream. You know, I appreciate every moment, you know, that the American give me. That's give me freedom, you know, give me protections. Protection from what? From tyrannies. You know, by what? By the blood of our men, our service men and women who fought and protect us to give us the shelters that we have here today, you know. So after, you know, I'm in my 50s now, and I look back and I said, well, what are we doing moving forward? No, literally, what's all of this? You know, all of us just live, and die, you know? So what's all of that all about, you know? And why is it there's no, why everybody's so different, right? You're different from me in many ways, you know, with one exception. The exception is that you're human too. You're not from Mars, you know? Yeah. I'm human too, you know? We're all from the same planet. That's the only similarity that's between the both of us. Other than that, we're so completely different. So the question is, in the birth of the universe, 16 billion years ago, right? Since the Big Bang. We met here today, this moment in time, about 16 billion years. Have you been born into another planet, into another galaxy, we would never met. How many galaxies are there? You do the math, right?
There's a lot.
But no, here.
There's a lot.
I know a lot. Or maybe if we were to be born as a chickens or a cow, you know, we would have never met. Or if your mom and dad had met each other just off by maybe a few years, you know,
there's no
you would never be born.
There's no Austin.
Yeah, there's no Austin.
Yeah.
So in the course of 16 billion years, you know, here we are today. What's the probability of that ever happen of us meeting, right? If you do the math, it's like, it's unfathomable, you know? So therefore, we know that the universe operates of math, not by accidents. Everything is by order, cause and effect. You know, so the universe itself, it's completely organized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no chaos. There's no such thing as random. What we know as random, but no, you know. So if that's the case, then what brought us here today is a sum result of all of our action that we have done in the past that lead us to where we are today. The earliest past was that I logged in about an hour ago. Right? That's the earliest. But there are, and then we met a little over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
because mm-hmm. You and I, we hook up about a year ago, here we are today. So it's a sum of all everything we've done in the past,
mm-hmm.
in this lifetime, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible in other lifetime too? Here we are possessing a body, an organic machines.
Mm-hmm.
You own the titles to Austins.
So far.
Haley
has a little bit of ability. Haley, my wife, she owns a little bit of it. But yes, yes. The rest is me.
I do agree with you on that part. So a happy home is a happy wife. So is it possible that you own other vessels, other vehicles too as well?
Mm.
You know, before you took titles to Austins, you know, but that title belongs to you only. It's given to you by mom and dad, right? Mom and dad said, well, you know what? Nothing is for free. Is it possible that you have done something for them in the previous past that lead them to that this moment as to we're going to give this to Austin? So all of that's raw possibility, even though we have no proof. We call reincarnations or possession or being possessed of a body to body. You know, God forbid us to be born in the possessive body of an Islamic extremist. You know, who taught the children to blow things up.
Yeah, yeah.
So if life, if that's the case, then there are what we call, there's certain things about life, you know, that cannot be refuted. Number one is the existence of sufferings.
Of what? What's the word?
The existence of sufferings.
Yes.
Suffers.
Yeah.
We suffer. Hunger is a sufferings. Birth is a suffering. Death is a sufferings. Sickness is a sufferings. So sufferings exist. Suffering is universal. No one can deny that, you know. Then you got physical sufferings and you got spiritual sufferings. Man, I only can afford McLaren. I want the Bugatti, a Koenigsegg. I'm suffering. Oh, I don't have a jet airplane yet. I'm suffering, you know. And the other suffering is that, man, I can't stand the liberal. I can't stand these this administration. I want them out of my sight. That's sufferings. Bring me back my hero, Donald Trump. He's not here yet. That's another sufferings, you know? So suffering is universal.
Sure.
That's what we call the fact of life.
Mm-hmm.
Fact of life number two is the cause of sufferings comes from desires and wants. Because we want things, we desire to have things. And when our desires are not met, we suffer. So, you know, and then is there any moment in time where our desire is actually completely met? No. Don't go old. Don't get fat, Thomas. You know, don't go hungry. Don't get sick. Oh, you know, don't get dumb.
Don't step off that curb. Don't step off that curb.
Right. So as a result of it, so the cause of sufferings is come from unfulfilled desires. Comes from desires that's been unfulfilled. And there's no desires in our life that have ever been fulfilled. You know. So, and the third fact is that if there's a cause of it, and there's a way to end it. You know, there's the end of cause of suffering. And the end of sufferings comes from knowledge, real knowledge. Knowledge of what? And acceptance. Knowledge and acceptance. Knowledge and acceptance of what? Of the law of natures. Of what? Nothing is permanent in this known universe. Nothing is permanent. Everything is impermanent. You know, we can say that, see this beautiful phone here? Oh my, I'm going to protect it as best I can. Oops, I dropped it. There goes the sufferings, you know? The phone itself is not permanent. We're not permanent. You know, we're just organic. The Play-Doh of the earth. You know, this Play-Doh of the earth was created in the womb of our mother with the seeds of our father. As a mother ate the organic materials and inorganic materials, outspun a little flesh, you know, initially, and eventually 9.5 months later, grew into a little boy called Austin. You know, so nothing is permanent, you know. So if we accept that everything is impermanent, and we understand the law of natures, then the end of suffering comes from by letting go, acceptance, be at peace with yourself, you know, be satisfied with what you have today. Suffering comes from desires that we want more. Mm-hmm. Wanting more is good. It's not a bad thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we cannot let go of things,
yeah,
and that's the result of our suffering. That's the fact of life. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, and I don't care what religion you're from or what race you're from or you're Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, same things. Everyone go through the same thing. And so the question is, how do we let go? You know, what do we need to do moving forward? Is that if we possess this body once called Austin's today, mm-hmm. is it possible we possess another? And then another and then another before we even arrive here today. And then is it possible that we can possess another one? Yes. Those are all possibility. But how do you guarantee that you don't, you know, exist in another shape or form that unfavorable? You don't, you know, but what you can do is that that the ultimate goal in life should be have complete peace. That I don't want to possess another body. I don't want another crapshoot. I don't want them to go through another Khmer Rouge, you know, ever again. But there's always Khmer Rouge around. Maybe in 10 years, 20 years down the line, America will become another Khmer Rouge. Who knows? You know, look at Cuba. They're the Khmer Rouge now, you know, North Korea the same way too. So how do we guarantee, you know, that we're so sick and tired of this? How many times we has gone through the cycles of birth, life, and death, or rebirth? I don't know. If it happened once, is it possible to happen again? Possible.
Maybe.
If that's the case, then what do we need to do? You know, my answer is pretty simple. You know, it's called the Eightfold Path. Have knowledge of natures. Knowledge of nature is what? The knowledge of karma. what you do is what you get. It's called karma. Action, reaction. Do good, you shall receive good. So, and then say good things. Do good things. Get into a profession that is a profession that does not hurt anybody. Like, for instance, don't sell guns. I'm going to take that back. You know, be in a profession that does not harm other people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like sales and engineers, you know,
mm-hmm.
That's what we do.
Manufacturing.
Right. You know, I mean, if we live a life that is incongruent with peace, you know, including say the right things, you know, say good words, think good things, you know, do good things, live a good livelihood, you know, be in a career of a good livelihood, be mindful of everything that you do, you know, so that if you lose your mindfulness, you know, you can cause accidents to happen, you know, that can intentionally or unintentionally hurt other people. So those are the good things. Those are the things that we have to do. At the same time, if the law of causality exists, then do as much good thing as possible. And that leads us to where I don't advertise that we do, but we enjoy doing it a lot, is charities. I do a lot of medical missions before the pandemics. 5% of our top lines goes to humanitarian services and charities. You know, we don't give to Red Cross, we just do things. And it just brings me a lot of joys, you know. I have some of the pictures posted on the Facebook page, you mm-hmm. know, we service like 5,000-6,000 people. I bring in doctors from Kaiser from here, take them to overseas, and just take care of 5,000-6,000 people for free of charge.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Build temples, monasteries, you know. Why temple monasteries? You know, it's a place of, it's a place people seek God, if you will. You know, when people are suffering spiritually, mentally, or whatever the case of their suffering, at the end of the day, where do they go to? They turn to God, or whatever God they turn to. They go to God.
They go to some religion. They go, I need something that's not from here, so that when I die, I know I'm going to do something better. I want to look forward to something. And religion's been that answer for many people. You know, honestly, I was curious about, you had taught me a few of the basics of Buddhism. And I really enjoyed listening to it because it really got me in tune with who you were, right? Because like, I didn't quite know you at the time. And like, we were trying to figure each other out. And you know, sorry, let me rephrase. I was trying to figure you out because I was the new kid in town. And you know, you probably knew who I was, you know, but I knew there was peace in you I had not met with anyone else. And I had gone to so many networking things in LA that just tired me out of posturing, pandering, and otherwise braggadocious behavior that wasn't really, it didn't feel authentic. And when you explained to me why you do what you do and what you do, like basically your profession is a driver to see how many more charities you can go serve. I don't know if that's something you've articulated, but it's a behavior you have, whether you've written it out or not. And I wanted to be around more people like that.
Austin, I'll share this with you. You know, when I was a child, you know, when I was in high school and college, I got a poster of a Lamborghini. Everyone has one, the Countach, yeah. You know.
Okay.
Like, it was beyond dream. It was not even fantasy. We cannot even fantasize anything like that. It was like, you know, it was, we don't know. We don't even have concepts of money, you know, to really fathom something like that. But once I got my first car, you know, it was a Honda Accord. I had enjoyment of about a month, maybe, you know. And then when the iPhone came out, I got the iPhone, you know, those enjoyment, those pleasures, if you will, they're just temporary. You know, they're not permanent. Getting and receiving gifts is great. You know, it's great, but you don't feel the satisfactions. It's because it's in our appetites, our vice is insatiable. You know, it doesn't bring us peace. Happiness is not peace, by the way. Peace is peace. So, but when we give, you know, when you give, when you affect someone else's lives, when you give, it stays with you more. I do it for a selfish reason, these charities, because it makes me more at peace. It gives me more satisfactions. I'm a selfish person. That's all I can say. You know, I don't really do it for them. I do it for myself. You know, yeah. I can do it for them, but the ulterior motive has always been, I do it for myself.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Do you know the ultra runner, David Goggins?
No.
He is an American. He was born in Illinois. He was raised in an extremely racist town as a black guy. And he is one of the only 77 SEALs who have graduated from SEAL training as a black man. And he has done numerous 100-mile races, and he's won all of the races you can possibly compete for. He set a world record for pull-ups at one time. Anyways, the main reason he did the races, do you remember in 2006, or do you know the movie Lone Survivor?
It's
Mark Wahlberg, and he's telling the story of Marcus Luttrell and Operation Red Wings, that I think 28 or 32 SEALs were killed in one battle. And it's the largest loss of life in the SEAL community ever to happen, ever. And David Goggins decided he would go do the 10 hardest races in the world as a fundraiser for the families of those who were fallen, because he didn't know what to do. And when I say the 10 hardest races in the world, I mean like the Badwater 135, 135-mile race in one sitting. Death Valley, there's a race where there's 10 to 12,000 feet of elevation gain over 100 miles. I mean, we're talking the hardest races in the world. And he said, I saw a letter in his book where he had raised over like $2 million for this fund as a Navy SEAL. Like, it doesn't really, like, he's just a special man. And one thing he says, when you're on mile 70, you're not thinking about the prisoner. You're not thinking about the families you raised funds for. That is long gone from your mind. You're there for you. Can David go from mile 70, where he's got blood pressure problems, he's urinating blood, he's pooping in his chair, he broke his feet in the course of this race, like the very first race that he always goes back to, and something snapped in his brain, and he got up, and he finished the race. So like, it was a 24-hour race. You had to do at least 100 miles or go for 24 hours without stopping. And one thing that's been interesting is because people label him as this or that, but it's really interesting how you say, it makes me feel better to do these things. It made David, he said, I wanted to be the hardest man in the world. I want to be known physically as the hardest man in the world. And he's still after it. He's still running. He's on Twitter. He's on Instagram. He's on Facebook. He's easily found, but he's still getting after it because that's what he needs for him. It's not for anyone else. It's not for the SEAL community. It's not for the money he raised. He did it because he wanted to. And I don't think, if you're not hurting someone else, I don't think there's really anything wrong with it. Like you're benefiting society by your charitable acts. He's benefiting some fundraisers, and he's getting himself sharper and physically more in fit. And that's his version. That's his stick, right? Like, I don't know what else to call it, but interesting how you say it's for you in a selfish way, but it's not negative. I don't think it's negative.
Right. That's, right.
You know, like, I think it's a blessing.
We human being, this is a fundamental basic nature as a human being. We're mm-hmm. all selfish.
Yeah.
All of us, 100%. I myself included, the Pope, everyone else. We're selfish. Sure. We do it for myself. Whether myself physically or myself spiritually, it's always about me, I. We're impatient. We want things fast. We're greedy. We want more good things, you know. We're selfish, we're greedy, we're impatient. The question is how do we apply that? Society, when applied correctly, we grew. We got cars because we're impatient. We got airplanes because we're impatient, you know? We got washing machines instead of washing what on my hand like I did back in the days, you know? So we grew, you know? So as being a selfish, we do it to save our own soul. We do it for our own satisfaction. Yeah. Even the guy who commits suicide, you know, he's moving, he's believing that he's doing the right thing. He's moving away from pain and suffering toward a better place. The guy who does surgeries, whether it's a surgery that he does for, you know, to make him or her look good or to deform him or her faces, just for that, still they believe that's better for them, you know. So in life, you know, we're supposed to walk what we call the middle path. There is no correct middle. The middle path is not, you take a piece of paper, you got the left and right, draw a line in between and say, that's the middle path. That's the right path. No, you know, everybody's middle path is different. It's different because of all the previous paths to lead to where you are today. You know, that's that brings you to your middle path. Your background is different. Mm-hmm. So let's say, for instance, right? Some people find joy in hurting other people. Well, that's their middle path. You know, they believe that they're doing betterment of societies. I'm talking about Allah Akbar, you know, all these Hezbollah and all those guys.
Yeah.
And then some Buddhist monks, you know, lives in a palace. That's his middle path. And some Buddhist monks live in the jungle, eating rotten things, scavenging for food. You know, is his practice any better than the guys who's living inside the palace, eating, you know, meat served in a golden plate? No. And the reason is because we have to ask himself, why do people eat rotten stuff at the jungle? It satisfies him. It satisfies his soul. It's not necessarily the right path, you know? Yeah. So, and the other guy who lives inside the palace getting served, you know? I mean, he could be more virtuous than the guy going through the, living inside of the jungle. So everybody's path is different, you know? I do what I do is because it makes me satisfied, you know? So if I were to do someone else, if someone else say to me, oh, you should give it to Greenpeace. No, hell no. But the guy who's serving Greenpeace is satisfied because he'd rather save the whale, you know? Or maybe in his previous life, he's been killing too many whales. Now this lifetime, he's, you know, he may have been the an Indians or a Japanese fisherman's.
Mm-hmm.
All they do is just kills whales.
Yeah.
Now this lifetime, he's been born back. He said, I see whales. Oh, I love whales. I see dog. My heart goes to dog, you know. Well, go ahead and serve your dogs. You know, that's your middle path, you know. But I'm going to serve human being. It's because maybe I didn't kill enough dogs in my previous life.
Sure, right.
Who knows, yeah, right?
Yeah, whatever the thing is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, whatever that is. So everyone has their own path, you know. And the measurements of whether or not that path is a good path for you and for you only, is in the result. Does it give you peace? You know, if it gave you peace, if it makes you satisfied and give you happiness, then that's the answer. If it doesn't, if it creates sufferings, you know, if it creates hatreds in your heart, it creates uneasiness in your heart and mind. It's not the wrong path.
Correct. I have a friend who said, he says it like this: find your lane, stay in your lane, and perfect your lane.
Sound like a race car driver.
No. It's just we all have a path. We all have something we're going to gravitate towards, and you really have to, you got to find it, you know, and then you have to hone it. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just, you know, I'm going into high school, I was 6'2", 185 pounds. I was a big 14-year-old. I knew my path for a while was going to be athletics. I knew it was going to be. Like, I loved it. It sang to my soul. It really did. It brought me pleasure to play football. And as that time ended, I realized that I needed a new path. And I got into what I got into with sports. And then it's kind of led into the two things it's in now. And I don't think, professionally speaking, I've found what I'm looking for. And what's interesting, you say, because you're using language I've felt within the past 3 or 4 months and not been able to put words onto it. And like, I appreciate this phone call because honestly, I'm gaining a ton from it. You know, not you, you have a great story. Like, I love praising that story. I want to give that a biggest platform as I possibly can, and I will. But I get some too, you know, like, I get some joy from this because I've really suffered in trying to figure out, is this insurance thing for me? And I'm realizing it's not, and that's okay. And I'm headed in a direction that I think is going to give me a better sense of peace. And I'm the prospect of what I'm going to be doing is speaks to the skills I already have. It's very interesting the way you've termed that, you know, the way you struggle if you're not on that path, or you're suffering if you're not on that path, and you've got to find a way to get to it, to get that peace. And I guess that's what I've been chasing and have not been able to articulate. So thanks.
You're welcome. I love to educate, by the way. And one thing I do learn is that don't believe anything that is written, said by anyone, but thou shalt think for thyself.
Yeah.
And if you don't get it, it's okay. Not everyone's going to get it because everyone has a different background.
Sure.
But my job, I love to instill thinking upon people, make them think for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and then with that knowledge, if they can turn that knowledge into an understanding of their own life, then they become wiser.
Yes, they do.
I want people to develop wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, and wisdom and faith is two opposite spectrums. Faith is just to believe something someone said or written. Wisdom is don't believe, but thou shalt think for thyself. Thou shalt questions.
Mm-hmm.
When you find your answer, when it makes sense to you, you become the wiser person.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, you know, the existence of sufferings. That's what all life is. Life is nothing more or less than sufferings. Whether you're a king, prince, rich or poor, we're all suffers.
Yeah.
You know? So if life is sufferings, the question is, damn, how do I end this stuff?
How do I ease this burden? Yeah.
Yeah. How do I stop this? I'm so sick of it. So sick and tired of sufferings. I suffer enough already, you know. Sure, you know, I mean, suffering in the sense of that, you know, it's never ending process. You have children, you're attached to your children. Your children are not complying to the path that you want them to go. That's sufferings. I mean, behind closed door, this morning, man, we have a lot of come to Jesus talks. those are suffering for me too, you know?
Yeah.
So at the end is that, you know, what I want to do is I want to instill wisdom upon people by making things, by helping them think and using logic for themselves.
Hang on. That didn't go through on the telephone.
I think I lost you right there. Hold on. Yeah. His battery's dying. Okay, yeah. Here we go.
You're good.
Okay. So, well, Austin, I'm glad that you you can get something from it, you know. But if you really want to understand more of our fundamental foundations of our family life and our professional career is based off of Buddhism, if you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism is pretty simple, mm-hmm. you know. The study of Buddhism is actually very, very simple. So simple, it's not even funny. But damn, it's hard to practice, you know. The fundamental five virtues that we all should have, and I myself cannot even hold it correctly. Number one, abstain from killing. It's abstinence from taking life. Number two, abstain from taking what is not given or stealing. Well, number three, abstaining from sexual misconduct. Thus far, I've been pretty good with these three. Number four, abstain from lying. That's hard work. That's a hard work.
Say it again. Abstain from what?
From lying.
Lying.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Don't tell the truth. Fibbing. You know.
Yeah.
And number five is the hardest one of all. Abstain from consuming any form of intoxicant. Mm. I love wine and alcohol. You know, because if you lose your mindfulness as a result of intoxicants, you can violate the all four. Because the goal is to be as mindful as possible, always knowing what you're doing at all time. You know, and I'm not very successful in that. That's the fundamental five virtues of Buddhism. If we can do that, and then if we want to have spirits of an angel, that's just to separate us from human being, a five. You know, in other words, human from animal. If we can't hold those, we're no less than an animal. And I can tell you, I violate number five. And number four, I ain't good at number four. And I'm mindful enough to know that I'm sucked at those two. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Then if we want to have the heart of an angel, and we can, the heart of an angel is let's see what they call it. It's called I know in Bali language, but I don't know in English. It doesn't translate that well. It's called let me see if we can find it the translation in English a little bit. It's called Hiri Otapa. That's in Bali. It means that having a sense of shame with moral calm and fear of wrongdoing. So in other words, let's say Austin, behind your back, I'm stabbing you behind your back for a quick financial gain. Let's say that's the case, right? I gain your trust and all. Well, if I have a heart of an angel, I have what they call a sense of shame, you know, with moral calm and fear of wrongdoing means that, you know what? Karma is coming after me. You know, a fear of the repercussion that nature is going to send in my way. For instance, those Khmer Rouge that tried to kill me, you know, it wasn't happening by accident. Sure, I'm acting like a little innocent little a boy this lifetime to those guys. Who knows? Maybe 1,000 years ago, I was the Thai military, you know, that invaded Cambodia and massacres the Khmer Empire, mm-hmm. because there's war between the border, you know?
Yeah.
There've always been war between those borders. Maybe I was one of them,
yeah.
you know, 1,000 years ago. And now this lifetime, they're coming back, they're coming to seek payment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe that when we run into people in our life, people who comes into our life, they come for one of the two reasons. Number one is to take payment. Payment of what? to pay back our karma debt to them. Someone, when someone cheated us, you know what? They come back for it. When our girlfriend dumped us, you know, and caused us pain, they're just coming back for payment. So those people who are within us, and after they're satisfied with their payment, they leave on their own accord. You know, we go our separate ways. We're done. I never want to see you again, you bastard. You know?
Yeah.
May you go burn in hell. You know, that kind of stuff. They already received their payment and they're satisfied. They leave.
Yeah.
If they're not satisfied yet, and if the debt has not been completely paid yet, lawsuits after lawsuits after lawsuits after lawsuits. Yeah. When the hell this is going to end, you know? Or it applies to both relationships, to financials, to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side is that those who are coming to gain, those who are coming to build karmas together, you know? So you got people who becomes friends, who work so well together, and they do things together. For what? For the greater goods. Whatever greater goods is, whatever the metal path is, you know, for the greater good. Could be save the whale is a greater good, you know? Or could be just helping one of the family member who's born physically impaired, you know? That's the greater good. So everybody has their own path, if you will, you know? So those are the two. A reason why people would meet.
For the greater good and for taking payment?
Yeah. In other words, they either come back, for payback.
Yeah.
To take payment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then the other is they come in so that you can build together.
Build together?
Build together.
Okay.
Be create together or build together or do goods together.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the two reasons. You know, it's
two reasons.
I like how simple that is. Like, I'm not gonna hold back from you. Like, when I study Christianity and as I practice Christianity, there's a lot of rules. There is a long list, like Old Testament and New Testament. Those are really long. There's 66 books.
I read the Old Testament 3 times. I read the Old Testament 3 times. Now the New Testament, I read countless times.
Yeah, yeah.
I went to church too, a lot. Yeah. Yeah. And to me, every religion has its purpose, has its good purpose. Now, what do I believe that Jesus is? I believe Jesus is a monk, not any ordinary monk. He's a monk. He is what we call known as a non-returner in English.
A non-returner?
A non-returner. There's four types of enlightenment in our belief. The ultimate form of enlightenment is known as a non-returner. Means that you have achieved the ultimate as far as spirituality already, you know. And then you won't return back as a human being anymore. You're done with the cessations of birth, life, and death. He is the ultimate or the epitome of what a monk or an individual should build themselves as that. I wish one day to be a non-returner too as well, because I'm so sick and tired of sufferings, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we believe. That Jesus is, you know, he had built enough karma in all his previous life, you know, whether good karma or bad karma. In other words, he has large accounts that he already put into it. So when he at the last lifetime, which is a lifetime of this particular human being, you know, he have successfully achieved what he need to achieve. You know, that's what we believe that Jesus Christ is. He's a very holy man.
When I heard you talking, like, you were saying things that are from scripture, like the first time we met and you were telling me about who you were and kind of what you believe, I was like, This sounds really familiar. I've heard this before, you know, and it just, it made me feel very comfortable with you, because you don't just subscribe to what's best for the here and now. You know, you do have an eternal perspective. And I think there's not a large population of Earth's people have that, you know, comparatively speaking. And I am able to recognize that in you and enjoy seeing that in you. And hey, man, we need to land the plane. You've dropped a ton of wisdom. You've dropped a ton of knowledge. I got 3 pages of notes. You know, your story is, you know, I didn't even know it. And I know you, like, I kind of know you already. Like, and I just appreciate how much you're continuing to give back. And I know it's selfish, but I know that the people you give to really appreciate it. And you've been an example for me, because it's not anymore like my wife and I, we earn enough that like it's got to be for something else at this point. I don't know what the something else is, and we're starting to develop that charitable giving and the philanthropy in our own lives. We are trying to figure out what we want to do with it and where we want to go with it. And you have a global perspective as well. Like, and you have, you know, and it, I just, you're a blessing to me, you know, whether you know that okay. or not. And I just appreciate how much time you've put into your business, how much energy you have, the things you've told me about how you've raised your oldest boy and some of those good stories. And, you know, I wish you continued success in both the charity and the professional development, you know, and with that charity at the helm, I know it's going to grow. There's no way it cannot grow if that's the goal.
Austin, once this house is done, I'd like to invite you and your wife to come over and have dinner. We're 80% done. And right now we have such a problem with a contractor, because everybody is renovating. There's not enough contractor.
Everyone.
So we kind of put it, you know, we're still doing it. I mean, we put in a lot of effort into it. Now it's like, you know, we call up contractor. They don't even want to come. So there's still, once we're done, hopefully by this year, you know, want to invite you and your wife to come over.
Well, hey, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for this time and this story. And I think I'd love to have you back on to, you know, maybe go over what it was like in the camp. You know, if you're willing to share, I'm willing to listen.
I love to share. And every time I share, people said, you should be writing a book. And I said, you know what? I'm horrible with English. I don't have time to write books, but you're right. You know, if we have stories like this, which can serve as motivation and inspirations to the children, let them know that you could do things. You know, let them know that that CRT is just the opposite. CRT is non-motivational. It teaches you to be a loser. You know, and they pound it on our children
to accept losing. Yeah.
You know, to accept it and say that, to accept and give up, to completely give up.
Yeah.
The opposite is true with my story. It's like, no, you fight for survival. And you accept what's coming at you. And you try to do the best you can, you know.
If you met a ghostwriter and you spoke to a few ghostwriters, you would not have a problem putting a book together.
If you know one... I would love to share, and then we can benefit together. We can split, you know, however that he or she thinks that it's best to do. I don't want to leave this world without putting together a book. You know, it's so unfortunate, because my mother has already passed away. You know, I think 4 or 5 years ago. I would love to have my wish list was to have. was to have the story writer interview my mom too, to get her perspective, and then interview my relative in Cambodia, my family too, to get their perspective on everything. Because not all of us made it out alive. And then all of us who made it out alive, who's still alive, some of them did not escape. They lived through the Holocaust.
They stayed there. Yeah.
They stayed there. And two of my sisters, they lived through the Holocaust, you know?
Whoa.
And by the way, there's a happy ending story. And I think I'm going to save that one to the next surprise.
Yeah.
I'll show you, I'll walk you through the process and digging up information. I'll have information for you. There's happy ending to our story. My story here is happy ending, but there's happy ending to our stories. And the happy ending, and every Hollywood movies love a happy ending.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
So an hour is not just a happy ending, it's tremendous happy ending, you know? And I'll save that for the next time.
Okay. Okay. And we'll put a pin in it. We'll come back to it, man. Well, it's a blessing having you on, man. And we'll catch you some other time.
All right. Thank you, Austin. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
All right. You have a good weekend.